Yeah, and there was a lucky shot, I think, and I believe that there was a large explosion in the bridge area, so that there was no command ability left, and apparently the sufficient damage was done to the hull, so that it did the ship sank not long afterwards. I had seen Jordy Phillip with the Twigs down in the Southwest Pacific two or three times when his ship was in the harbor at in Seattle Harbor at Manus, and it was really rough to think on me to think that such a fine friend was no longer with us. Well, this has some connection with the two of our destroyers in the Navy. Jordy, G-E-O-R-D-I-E is the nickname he went by. Jordy Phillip had an uncle, John C. Waldron. John C. Waldron was a brother of Jordy Phillip's mother. She was a Waldron. John C. Waldron graduated from the Naval Academy in 1924. And I remember Jordy and I used to look through the 1924 lucky bag in his home, the Naval Academy annual, and it whetted our interest all the more in the Naval Academy. And John C. Waldron became an aviator, and at Midway led the famous Torpedo Squadron 8 into an attack on the Japanese carrier in which every torpedo plane was shot down by the Japanese, and only one man, one officer survived. An ensign, Gay was his name, G-A-Y. Ensign Gay was the only one. All the planes were mowed down, and of course, John C. Waldron perished.
So that family lost two naval officers.
Yes, and I'll add more to that in a moment. Yes, Mrs. Phillip had not only lost her brother in May of 42 at Midway, she now lost her son. Her older son at Okinawa, and not long after Midway, they named a Fletcher class destroyer the John C. Waldron, and such that ship operated with us during the war. Recently, about 2 years ago, about 1981, we launched a frigate, a modern frigate, which ship is now in commission, and it is the USS George Phillip. So today, The George Phillip is steaming in the fleet, a new modern ship, and I think it's probably about the fifth or sixth ship that's been named for deceased members of my Naval Academy class of 1935. Is the most recent, and I was just delighted that they named recently. Many years after the war, have named a ship the George Phillip. There previously was a USS Phillip, uh, 2100 tonner, one of the early ones commissioned in the early part of the war, named for Captain John W. Phillip, I believe, in the Spanish-American War, who commanded the Iowa, and said, "Don't jeer the four devils or die." We're referring to the Spanish. Right. Then I would just comment that the Phillips had another son, Bob, Robert Phillips, Bob, who I didn't know very well. He was younger than Jordy, and he went in the Marine Corps for the duration as an officer, and he was killed in, I think, 1944. So the Phillips had lost both of their sons in combat during the war, and only a daughter survived in that family. And then in addition, Mrs. Phillips had lost her brother. So this is just a bit of history which I pass on. And I think that we may, this might be a place for a break, Don. After spending the evening aboard the receiving ship in Fugushi Beach, Okinawa, spending the night on board, I was taken ashore next morning and reported to a headquarters there for transportation to Guam. There was a perhaps three military air transport services operating out of Yongtan Airfield on Okinawa, been providing air transport around the Pacific. First, I think the ATC, Air Transport Command, an agency of the Army Air Corps, the NATS, Naval Air Transportation Service, and the TAG, T-A-G, Transport Air Group, which was the air transportation arm of the Marine Corps. I was assigned to a plane of the Transport Air Group for passage to Guam. This plane was a Curtiss Commando C-46, manned entirely by Marine Corps aviation personnel. The accommodations were rather primitive, but that was all right. Anything to get transportation safely back to the United States was in order. Got aboard the plane and found there were bucket seats on either wall, and in the middle of the passenger compartment was a long auxiliary gasoline tank, so supplementing the plane's regular fuel tanks. There was a sign up there saying absolutely no smoking, and with some of the fumes of gasoline permeating the, the passenger cabin, no one was the least bit interested in doing any smoking. The C-46 in physical appearance looked a lot like a DC-3, twin engine, and configuration looked about the same as the good old Douglas DC-3, but it was much larger, a heavier plane, and carried more payload. And on my trip to Guam was the only time that I ever rode in a Curtiss Commando C-46. The Douglas DC-3 was the famous C-47. we took off from Yongtan Airfield, and I was glad when it got out of sight back over the horizon. We didn't expect to find any Japanese fighter planes sneaking in there, but after all, it was in a combat area, and conceivable that a plane could have gotten in there by surprise. We had a rather uneventful trip over the ocean. having left Seoul around 9:30 in the morning and arriving at Guam just about dusk. I recall that we could see some lights in the island there as we approached it at dusk, and they we could look right up to see the navigator up with the pilot and co-pilot, and every now and then during the afternoon he'd stick his head up into the bubble globe there and get a altitude reading on the sun with his octant. So apparently he was able to navigate the plane to a rather small point in the ocean at Guam. At Guam, I had to wait 4 days for onward transportation to Pearl Harbor. There was just a kind of a bottleneck in personnel transportation, and the number of planes needed wasn't always available. I didn't know it would be 4 days. Each morning we would go to the personnel office and you'd see if your name was called out for that day. And so for 3 days my name was never called out, and I went back to the officer's quarters that I was staying in. On the fourth day they called out my name and I got transportation. I did use the time to some advantage there. I had two senior officers whom I knew, and they were very, very good to me. First, Commodore John W. Magruder, who had a very important shore command there. I don't recall just what it was, but something involving logistics. And of course, as a captain, he had been my commanding officer for about 2 years on the Asiatic Station in the USS Augusta. And he was very kind to me and welcomed me. And then the other officer was Colonel John M. Arthur, U.S. Marine Corps, who in my days in the Augusta had been the fleet marine officer on the staff of the Commander-in-Chief Asiatic Fleet. He was then a lieutenant colonel. He was now a colonel, senior enough to have been promoted to general rank during the war, but somehow never was. But a very likable person. And Colonel Arthur had shore duty there of on Guam, and he made his jeep and driver available to me for a good part of a day, just to drive me around. So I had time to spare, and he thought I'd like to see Guam, and I did too. So Colonel Arthur's driver gave me a good tour of the place, and there were some places we didn't go because there were still a few Japanese holdouts, individual Japanese soldiers that were back in the way back in the bushes and whatnot that hadn't all come out yet. But the official instrument of surrender had been executed a year before, something like that, so that the place was completely in American hands. And incidentally, it was Colonel Arthur who told me, gave me the first information that General Buckner, the commander of the 10th Army, had been killed. Apparently, it was the same morning that I flew out of Okinawa, and this was the next day. General Buckner was killed yesterday when he was up inspecting in the forward lines, and a Japanese shell landed and a small splinter came off and got him right through the heart. Well, after 4 days, in Guam, I flew on to Pearl Harbor by the Naval Air Transportation Service, NATS, in a C-54. This was a four-engine Douglas plane and relatively new. They were just on the verge of being supplied to the commercial airlines at the time of the outbreak of the war. And we had a full plane, and I can only remember one senior officer on board was Rear Admiral Frederick C. Sherman, who was going from Guam back to the States. And he, as a captain, was commanding officer of the Lexington at the time. It was sunk in the Battle of the Coral Sea. We made the flight from Guam to Johnson Island. Not quite enough fuel to get the whole way to Pearl Harbor, or at least with a safety factor. I think Johnson Island is just a kind of a sandbar in the ocean about 700 or 800 miles from Hawaii. And so we were on the ground there, I'd say perhaps an hour and a half or 2 hours while they refueled the plane, and then we flew on to Pearl Harbor. I was at Pearl Harbor again about 4 days. Again, it was a matter of air transportation being in short supply, and it was a matter of waiting for your name to be called out each day. And on the fourth day, my name was called. Now, I had been asked if I would, I was given a choice of flying back on a commercial Pan American Clipper, or flying on a Naval Air Transportation Service C-54 four-engine plane like I had just come from in Guam. Although the Pan American Clipper was 5 or 6 or 7 hours longer in flight, I elected to take it.
I wonder why.
And enjoy all the delights of a nice sleeping cabin. Stewardesses to wait on you, all civilian and of course manned, and as a flying boat, had to get out there in the water at the, and boarded at the, I believe, the John Rogers Airport, the civilian terminal for Honolulu. And we boarded it there, and then took off and flew to San Francisco. It was a overnight flight, and I got in about 11 o'clock San Francisco time the next morning. So this would have been roughly around the 25th of June that I arrived back in the States. And my wife, I'm sure, had some idea I was coming because I had written her letters, but she couldn't know precisely. I told her within a day of when I would be there, and so I after arriving at Pan Am's water terminal there in San Francisco Bay, while I got transportation into San Francisco to the apartment hotel where we were living. Had a reunion with my wife, and then I recall I didn't have to report in to the commandant of the 12th Naval District, I think, until the 30th of June. So then that gave me about 5 or 6 days there, and before I even reported in to the commandant, just routine, and then I was granted some substantial amount of leave prior to reporting to my next duty station, which was the U.S. Naval Academy, to be become a member of the faculty there. That duty I'd asked for, and that I'm glad they were able to give it to me.
By this time, you knew that the war was winding down anyway, didn't
you? Yes, that's a good question. We felt that it was winding down to a considerable degree, but I must admit that the sudden Japanese capitulation did rather surprise me. At the time I left the Ammon, as I recall, we had already gotten aboard some directives for Operation Olympic. The not the detailed plans at all, but just some indication of planning for Operation Olympic, which was landing on the Japanese mainland on the southernmost island of Kyushu. And of course, we just assumed that the Japanese would just resist to the last man, that the ocean would be red with blood. So I had that feeling when I left the ship, but it soon became apparent after the Japanese capitulated completely on Okinawa that they were beginning to weaken. And then, of course, in early August, when the atomic bombs were detonated in Japan, I really felt things would cave in fast then. And that
I think that did actually save a lot of lives and a lot of time as far as the fighting was concerned.
I think so, yes. Many have argued, well, it wasn't necessary. The Japanese would have caved in anyway. And it is true they were in dire straits. They had very little fuel oil left for the ships of their navy. And they were in dire straits. And I think that, I don't think it would have taken much longer without the atomic bomb, but I think that, the bomb made it easier for the Japanese leadership to resolve the thing, to convince their people that we've just got to capitulate. Had the bombs not been dropped, I believe it would have been more difficult for the Japanese to come to that decision, and might have prolonged the war two or three months longer. But in essence, I think it was largely over in the summer of 45, as far as their long-term resources were concerned, because they were just so short of the essential raw materials for and munitions.
That you were talking about their resistance there on the Japanese islands proper.
Well, see, on the Japanese island, they might have fought harder to keep them, because that was their homeland.
Right.
It's one thing to be defending Okinawa, but it's something else to be defending your own homeland, right at the very center of your population. And since they have a kind of a history of fanaticism anyway, it wouldn't surprise me if they had kept on two or three months longer without the atomic bomb. And then I think that the lack of oil and the resources and metals and all would have finally just strangled them. They wouldn't have been able to go any further. I phoned my parents after a reunion with my wife. I phoned my parents in South Dakota and asked my dad if they had heard anything from the Phillips family about any possible consequences of the war. I had to speak kind of guardedly over the phone, and they said no, they hadn't. And
so they did not even know by that time.
That's
that
right.
Some was...
Here it was 10 days later, and the Navy Department had not yet notified the Phillips family that their son George was gone. And so my dad said no word. And I said, well, Dad, I just hate to tell you, but I said, I think Geordie's gone. I couldn't go into too much detail. I did say that his ship was his ship was apparently sunk, and I had talked to some survivors. Of course, I never mentioned the name of the ship over the phone. It wasn't essential, but I said, I've talked to a number of the survivors, and none of them saw the captain after the ship was sunk. And I'm just afraid that he's gone. Well, this was, of course, quite a shock to my parents. And I know my father, then, called a Rapid City, it was halfway across the state, a third party, a good businessman who was a good friend of Geordie Phillips' father as well as my father. And he called him, rather than Mr. Phillips directly, because he thought he would know right away if any word had been received. And this third party friend of my father said, no, they haven't had any word at all. And so my dad relayed the message to them, and my dad relayed the message that I'd given, to this third party, who then took it upon himself to go around and break the news to the Philippines. And so that's how they got the news of their son's death, even before the Navy Department notified them. Well, those are just little bits of history that might be of interest possibly sometime. My wife and I had a few days in San Francisco. That's the only town we'd known since we were married in the fall of 42. Pretty well got our belongings, which in those days weren't much. Didn't have any furniture of any kind, just personal belongings, and got them packed up and shipped to Annapolis, and we took off by train across the country to Omaha, and then up to my own hometown in South Dakota. Had a nice visit there for a few days. In my hometown of Chamberlain, we went up and drove to the Black Hills, the Mount Rushmore area there, and to Rapid City. Had a visit with Mr. and Mrs. George Phillip, and we toured the Black Hills and enjoyed all the fine scenery there, and then went on to thereafter by train to the Cleveland, Ohio area, where my wife's parents were living, or they were from. Had a nice visit there, and several days, and then I went on to Annapolis alone by train and reported in for duty there, and found after a few days that I could get government quarters. We could get government quarters. Another officer and his family, another officer being transferred, had not moved out yet, but would shortly, and my wife and I could have these apartment there and government quarters. And I think after a couple of weeks or so, my wife came from Cleveland, and we got settled in Annapolis in August of 45, as I recall. I remember I was in Annapolis at the time that the bombs were dropped, and the Japanese surrender came about a short time after that. I was assigned to the Department of Marine Engineering as an instructor, and I felt that that was a good assignment. They considered sending me to Department of Seamanship and Navigation, and or Ordnance and Gunnery, but I felt at home, more at home in Marine Engineering, because I had served as an engineer officer of two destroyers and a water division officer of the cruiser Augusta, and so this was all good background for 2 years of enjoyable time there and instructing midshipmen the sophomore and second year midshipman in the naval machinery, boilers and pumps and things like that. I found it very rewarding. I wonder if this might possibly be a good time to take a break.
This is the end of interview number 6.